Well, we're very privileged today to have Professor Alistair Lucas with us, who's the Dean of Law at the University of Calgary. Professor Lucas has taught there since 1976, particularly in regulatory issues related to energy and environmental law. And he's served as the Executive Director of the Canadian Institute of Resources Law, and also on many, many other organizations relating to the petroleum industry and petroleum law. He's published over a dozen books relating to oil and gas law in Canada, as well as dozens of articles relating to regulatory issues in Canadian and international law. Most recently, and what caught my attention, was an article he did in a new book on the history of the Alberta Supreme Court, dealing with the history of energy law in Alberta, and particularly with some of the major cases that have come to the fore over the last 75 years. And his topic today will be the Supreme Court of Alberta and the petroleum industry, some of the landmark cases. Please welcome Alistair Lucas.
Thanks very much. It's a welcome opportunity to speak to the group today. I'm going to be very low tech today. I have a handout. I will ensure that the outline that's going around is available digitally, but for today, we can just look at it, okay? What I tried to do is to look at a series of landmark judicial decisions by the Supreme Court of Alberta, the Supreme Court of Canada, and in the case of some of the older cases, by the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council in England, which used to be, until 1949, the final court of appeal for cases that arose in Canada. So I've tried to be selective, and the idea here is to look at what these court decisions have done in relation to the energy industry, particularly the oil and gas industry. And my thesis is that the court, and particularly through these landmark decisions, has established a legal environment that's permitted the industry to flourish, to advance, to do what it needs to do. Okay. Now, I appreciate that some of you may have not had particular experiences with lawyers and litigation that have always been entirely positive. Okay, I'm aware of that. I'm speaking about trends here, and trying to look at the bigger picture. So, if you look at the outline, I referred to the idea of jurisdiction, and essentially, jurisdiction means legal authority to pass legislation, to make decisions under powers that are given by legislation. The legal power to do something, and the do something usually means something that affects us as citizens. Okay? And if you kind of glance through the handout, you'll see that I've actually underlined the term jurisdiction wherever I've used it in relation to these various cases. And the reason I did this is we've had a very nice gift from Murray Edwards at the Faculty of Law. Murray has given us $2 million that the university and the government have matched to create a chair, an endowed chair in the law school. And Murray was very particular about the subject of the chair. And it's going to be called the N. Murray Edwards Chair in jurisdiction and business law. And Murray was very keen that the term jurisdiction should help to define the scope of the chair and the area of research that the chairholder is going to undertake. And I hope that by the time we're finished in the next few minutes, you'll see what Murray was after when he was so keen about having jurisdiction as the focus of the chair. So, you can see, first of all, the oil patch in Canada has not been very litigious. There have been things that have gone to court, and these are some examples I'm going to talk about. But if you look at other places, if you look south of the border, there's really no comparison. A lot more has been decided in the courts in the U.S. and in the various oil and gas states than has ever been the case in Canada. But at the same time, the courts have always been there when people couldn't settle their own disputes. Okay, there was always the recourse of going to court, and because that was the case, these were the disputes that the people involved couldn't settle themselves. They were important disputes. They were important issues, and typically they were issues that affected more than the particular parties to the case. So, as I've indicated already in the chapter in the book on the Alberta Supreme Court at 100 on the energy sector, I've focused on landmark cases, and the idea is that the decisions in those cases have helped to sort of set the tone and resolve some key issues that have permitted the energy industry to go forward and to flourish in Alberta. So, case number one concerned circumstances that existed a long time ago. In 1905, when Alberta became a province, and the other focus is 1930, when the federal government finally gave us our resources. Right, the Natural Resources Transfer Agreement of 1930. And in that interim period, the way you acquired oil and gas rights was by going not to Edmonton, but to Ottawa. Okay, so the case, the Spooner Oils versus Turner Valley Gas Conservation Board, concerned a grant of oil and gas rights that was a federal grant, okay? And so Spooner had federally granted oil and gas rights in the Turner Valley that the company was exploiting. They had drilled wells. They were producing. But as you know, things production-wise at that time in the Turner Valley weren't quite what they are now. And gas was being flared all over the place, including by Spooner. And the initiative in Alberta was to conserve, to try to put a lid on the excessive flaring of natural gas. And as a result, legislation was passed, the Turner Valley Gas Conservation Act, and a board was set up, the Turner Valley Gas Conservation Board. The board made orders that had the effect of conserving natural gas, putting a lid on flaring, including shut-in orders. And Spooner was the subject of shut-in orders. So that was the legal challenge. And what Spooner was challenging was the jurisdiction, right, the legal authority of the Turner Valley Gas Conservation Board to issue that order to the company. There was a little matter of enforcement out there in the field, and people running around with firearms and things of that sort. But that's another matter. Okay, that's sort of on the enforcement side. So when this got into court, the Alberta courts agreed with the Alberta government that the government was entitled to make the order. The government had the jurisdiction to make the order. However, on appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, the Supreme Court of Canada disagreed. And they said, well, if you look at Spooner's grant, the effect of this order is to alter the grant. It has the effect of changing the rights that the federal government granted to Spooner, right? So the grant of the rights was by the federal government. The Supreme Court said, constitutionally, the province doesn't have the jurisdiction to affect those federally granted rights. Okay? So you can see that was what the court said. The problem was that the Alberta order altered or affected the pre-1930 federal oil and gas rights that Spooner had. Okay, that was the particular case. But along the way, the Alberta courts and the Supreme Court of Canada didn't challenge this, agreed that the Alberta government had the constitutional jurisdiction, the constitutional authority, the legal authority to regulate natural gas production for conservation purposes. Okay? So this is the decision that originally confirmed the kind of jurisdiction that the Energy Resources Conservation Board, the EUB, and back to ERCB now has been exercising since the 1930s. Okay? The other thing that this case did is the courts confirmed that the Crown agreement that Spooner had was a lease, okay? And it was a lease that granted property rights, because the other possibility was that it was simply a statutory permission, right? So that the oil and gas rights remained with the government, in this case the federal government, and the Crown agreement just had the effect of giving Spooner Oil permission to explore for, produce, and market petroleum and natural gas. The court said, no, that's not what this is. It's a lease in the real property sense. It grants property rights. Okay? And so that confirmed an idea that has had an impact in the way the industry operates, in the way that companies do business, in the way companies have been able to finance their operations, right? Under Crown agreements, they've got real property rights, not just a sort of discretionary statutory permission to go out and explore. So for those reasons, the Spooner Oil case was very significant. Okay, so that's case number one. Case number two, I've kind of labeled it Leduc and the Leduc fallout. I don't mean nuclear fallout or anything like that. I mean the aftermath of Leduc. Okay, Hubbard Assets and Attorney General of Alberta, and this was another one of these early federal grants. The significance of the Hubbard Assets case is something that is near and dear to the hearts of many, and I'm sure everybody in this room has at one time or another expressed views on this, and namely royalties and the government's power to set royalties and to change royalties and royalty rates. What the Hubbard Assets case did is confirm that the province of Alberta had jurisdiction, the legal authority, to establish what was described as a variable royalty. Okay? So to grant mineral rights subject to a royalty, and three lines from the bottom on the first page is the terminology. The royalty was from time to time as prescribed by regulation. Okay? And the argument of Harvard assets was, that's not clear and certain enough. The courts, ultimately, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council here, which still had appellate jurisdiction at that time, disagreed and said, as a matter of constitutional law, as a matter of public law, and as a matter of clarity of the regulations, the government actually does have the authority to prescribe the royalty. They do that initially in the legislation. They incorporate that into the grant of mineral rights, and they retain then through the government's authority to make laws, right, to change the regulations, the jurisdiction, the legal authority to change the rate of the royalty. In Harvard Assets, it was actually a case of imposing the royalty in the first place. The mineral rights that were granted here did not have a royalty attached, but simply the grant said a royalty as may from time to time be prescribed by regulation. Okay, so part of the argument in this case was it an outright sale of the mineral rights, or was it a lease subject to royalty? And the court concluded that it was the latter. And then the further issue was this reservation of royalty as may from time to time be prescribed by regulation clear enough? And the ultimate result of the case was the court said, yes, it was clear enough. Okay, so what that meant was that back in 1973-74, and you'll remember that, right? Remember when the price of oil went from $3 a barrel to over 12 practically overnight? And one of the next things that happened is that Peter Lougheed and his crew were busy looking at the royalty regulation and revising that royalty regulation, adjusting it in light of the market price that was established, the much higher market price, fourfold increase established at that time. So this kind of royalty adjustment is by no means new, and the Hubbard Assets case makes it pretty clear that whatever political recourse the industry or individual companies or individuals in the industry may have on this, they really don't have any legal recourse to challenge the change of royalties by regulation. Okay, I mean that's the bad news. The good news is that it's all in the political arena, so it's a lot more fun. Okay, so that's the Hubbard Assets case, and then. The next case, this is still LaDuke and following, is a case called Borys versus the CPR. And some of you may have encountered this judicial decision. This is the case that is still very much in people's minds because it had the effect of demarcating, for legal purposes, ownership of petroleum and natural gas in the reservoir. Okay, so what happened was that there was a CPR grant to Farmer Borys in 1918, and the grant reserved, as was typical at that time, all coal, petroleum, and valuable stone. Okay, and it's the term petroleum that caused all the trouble, because the CPR then turned around and leased its petroleum rights to Imperial Oil. Imperial Oil was out there exploring. Okay, I'm not sure exactly the location of this property in relation to the original Leduc discovery, but it wasn't far away. Some of you may know a little more about precisely where this property was. But, so what happened is that Imperial started to drill a well, and Boris became a little bit concerned about what was going on, and discovered that, got a bit of advice, and discovered that while Imperial owned the oil, it was certainly arguable that he continued to own the natural gas. And so that's what the dispute was all about. So Boris went to court and initially got an injunction against Imperial stopping the drilling on the basis that Imperial wasn't in a position to produce its oil without also producing some gas, and so affecting the natural gas rights of Mr. Boris. So part of the problem was, what did this grant mean? What did petroleum mean in the grant? Did petroleum include oil and natural gas? And the court said, and the courts were in agreement on this, all the way up from the Alberta Trial Division to the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council. They said, as a matter of interpretation, what we're trying to do is figure out what the parties to the agreement intended, to the parties to the grant. Here, Boris and the CPR. What did they understand was their agreement? And that meant that the court had to focus on what they described as the vernacular meaning. What would the term petroleum mean to people at that time in 1918? But the court was clear. You know, they weren't saying what would petroleum mean to the person in the hardware store down the street, or the guy driving the buggy over there. They said you'd have to look at what landowners would understand petroleum to mean, what business people, what engineers would understand petroleum to mean, and sort of figure it out that way. But what you couldn't do is focus on a bunch of technical evidence as to what petroleum meant. In other words, a whole bunch of geologists and petroleum engineers. The court said, we're not going to rely on them. Okay, so you got the message here. it's what the people think, not what the experts think. So on that basis, the court came to the conclusion that what the parties would have understood at that time was that petroleum meant oil and wouldn't have included natural gas. And because the grant was made before anybody had drilled into the formation, they were dealing with the substances in their original condition in the formation, right? So that meant that solution gas, okay, to the extent that natural gas was in solution in the reservoir, that is the property of the oil owner. Okay, now this caused a lot of trouble, as I'm sure you're all aware. So I just wanted to point out a couple of things about the case. In the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, Lord Porter, one of the judges, said, well, we agree with the Alberta courts on the approach, the interpretive approach, the vernacular meaning, and the idea that we have to focus on original reservoir conditions. He said, we agree with all of that. But then he went on, and I quoted here, right? He said, the Court of Appeal adopted a compromise. Namely, and this is what caused all the trouble, the condition of the substance as it emerges from time to time from the reservoir. Okay, so on the one hand, they've said original reservoir conditions, and then the condition of the substance as it emerges from time to time from the reservoir. So that left open all kinds of arguments that focus on the movement of substances into the wellbore, the wellbore, okay? this wasn't sorted out for a long time in legal terms, and I've cited another case here, a much more recent case called Anderson against Amoco Canada, which was finally decided by the Supreme Court of Canada in 2004. And I quoted a short passage from the judgment of Justice Adele Fruman, who was the original trial judge on this. And this is how she summed it up. And basically, the Alberta Court of Appeal agreed with her, and so did the Supreme Court of Canada. Okay? So she says, Boris stands for three propositions. Right? Solution gas belongs to the petroleum owner. Okay? Original reservoir conditions. Free gas, primary gas cap gas belongs to the non-petroleum owner. Right? And then thirdly, gas that emerges from solution in the reservoir at the bottom of the well or at the surface or anywhere in between belongs to the petroleum owner. Okay? So she's put to rest this idea that you focus on the entry to the well bore. It's what ultimately comes out of the well. So there you have it. And has that answered all the questions then about the demarcation between oil and gas? It's answered quite a few of them, but as I've indicated in the outline, there's another big one that's coming along, right? Because if you go back to the reservation in the Boris grant, the reservation was all coal, petroleum, and valuable stone. And now the question is, what the heck does the term coal mean? Right? In terms of the black stuff and coal bed methane. And as you know, this is a serious issue out there. The Energy and Utilities Board had this before them a year ago last fall, and their decision was that they were prepared to grant well licenses to the natural gas holders, the natural gas rights holders in that proceeding, on the basis that their legislation says that parties that are entitled to a particular resource are entitled to apply for a well license. But that doesn't settle ownership. That simply settles the jurisdiction, right? The legal authority of the EUB to grant the well licenses. So the fundamental question of ownership of coal bed methane as between coal owners and natural gas owners still has to be sorted out, and the starting point is going to be the Boris case. Okay? The last case in this little trip, and I'm going to slide, but I've got one prop here, and I'll get to that in just a second. The National Energy Program, right? Everybody remembers the National Energy Program. So I can just see, you know, faces getting redder, and people clenching the arms of their chairs. So I had to dig around to find this, but here it is. Okay? An honest to God copy, an original. I mean, this may be worth something for all I know. The National Energy Program. There it is, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? See, and you remember what it was about, the federal grab. It had to do, remember, about Canadian ownership. That was a big part of it. And then a whole bunch of taxes. We were still in the regulated pricing era at the time, and the feds put their hand into that big time. And then there was a series of new taxes, the petroleum and gas revenue tax, a natural gas tax, and there was a proposal for a natural gas export tax, which was going to be very significant at the time. But the NEP ultimately did not include the natural gas export tax. And the reason it didn't is the last case on my agenda here, a case called Reference Re-Proposed Federal Tax on Exported Natural Gas. How much more boring can you get when it comes to the title of one of these cases, okay? 1982. So what happened here was that the Alberta government objected very vigorously to, obviously, all of the NEP proposals, but this natural gas tax really got them going. So they decided to sort of counter-strike. And what they did is framed a reference case that was submitted to the Alberta Court of Appeal and then ultimately was decided by the Supreme Court of Canada. And a reference case is a sort of hypothetical case based on a scenario. Sometimes it's based on a piece of proposed legislation, okay? And in this case, the proposed legislation was the proposed amendments to the federal excise tax that would have imposed this tax on exported natural gas. But you need a context for it. You need a scenario. So this is the scenario, a couple of little bullets that the Alberta government came up with. Okay, the scenario was the Alberta government drills a gas well in southern Alberta. The Alberta government then contracts for processing and for gathering and processing of the gas and for construction of a dedicated pipeline to deliver the gas to a U.S. purchaser. You think, what the heck is going on here? Right? I mean, that's fantasy. Right? Is that something the Alberta government would ever dream of doing? Right? The government itself going out and drilling a natural gas well and getting into the business of producing and marketing natural gas itself. I mean, never mind the Alberta Petroleum Marketing Commission that some of you had to deal with. But this is just not the way it works at all, right? The government leases the rights, get a crown lease, and just as soon as, assuming anything is discovered, the natural gas is produced, it becomes the property of the lessee, right? Of the operating company. And at that point, there's no doubt that it can be taxed by the federal government. Okay? The strategy here was to rely on a provision in the Constitution that prohibits one level of government taxing another, okay? Preventing the federal government from imposing taxes directly on the provincial governments and their agencies and vice versa. So that's the reason for the scenario. And the courts agreed that, okay, as long as the Alberta government continues to own the natural gas to the moment it crosses the U.S. border, it's gas belonging to its property of the provincial government and cannot be taxed by the federal level of government. So this was a little bit of a slowing of the momentum that had been developed by the federal government in rolling out the National Energy Program. Now, other events then came along, including a change of government in Ottawa, of course, and the NEP kind of eventually trickled into the sand. But the reference case here was an important shot in the process of slowing down the momentum that had been created by the federal government in proposing the National Energy Program. So, as I said at the beginning, the conclusion from all of this is that these are landmark cases in the development of Alberta's petroleum industry, and that if you look at these decisions as a whole, they really had the effect of supporting a sort of made-in-Alberta system of running the oil and gas industry. That is, private development of public oil and gas rights in a pretty much, right, discussion about royalty reviews aside, perhaps, pretty much a collaborative manner. Okay, so that's what I've come up with, and I'll be happy to answer your questions. Yes.
Regarding the Hubbard asset, was this the property that was owned at one time by the Kennecott Napoleon in the north? It was the